Well, we know what it's like to feel worried and helpless about the state of our world.
But we're finding comfort and inspiration from people tackling winner-take-all economics and other root causes of climate change, inequity, and global unrest.
Join us on the road from wasteland to wonderland. This is Pot of Gold.
In this episode, we speak with Evelyn Lindner, a German-born doctor, scholar, and nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize for her work to secure human dignity worldwide.
As part of her work, Evelyn lives her life as a global citizen, which means she sees the entire planet as her home. She travels from family to family, actually becoming a part of each family, and spreading her message of peace and of building a global community. We're especially excited to have Evelyn for her relationship with money. In fact, she tries to live without it as much as possible.
Let's hear a bit from Evelyn. It's really wonderful to have you here with us.
It's my honor. I'm so happy and privileged and honored to be here.
So today we're speaking with Evelyn Lindner, and may you please introduce yourself.
My name is Evelyn. When I'm asked, where are you from? That is normally the first question. I'm in deep trouble because I cannot really answer that question easily. So if I'm meeting a customs officer, I say I have here my German passport. Then if I meet somebody in the street, I may say I am born in Europe. And if I want to really, be a little bit funny, I say, oh, I'm from planet Earth, like you, you know.
That's great.
So the best answer is I'm from planet Earth, and I'm a global citizen, and it's not just a theory, it's a real practice of more than 45 years. Of living globally, being at home and on all continents, not being a guest, not being a tourist, not being a traveler, never going back, always going forward. So it's really like living in the global village. And if you live in a village and you move a bit, you don't travel, you simply live there.
To further the introduction, I know that you've been nominated several times for a Nobel Peace Prize. Can you tell us why?
Because this is a work that is in line with the testament of Alfred Nobel. If you look at the past millennia, then you have something that political scientists call the security dilemma. And especially Norway was, it was very relevant. Norway thought that in 1939, still they thought that Germany was their friend. Many people in Norway spoke German. And then one day Hitler sends his battleship up the fjord to Oslo and occupies Norway. Suddenly, from one day to the other, a neighbor is an enemy. And that experience was definitorial for the past basically 10,000 years after the Neolithic Revolution. This is, of course, extremely simplified what I say now, but very, very simplified. You could say that after the Neolithic Revolution, about 10,000, 12,000, 11,000 years ago, it started to become like that, that you, when you lived in one place, you had to be afraid of your neighbor. The neighbor could suddenly come and attack you. This is called the security dilemma. What you do in that situation is you get some weapons because you need to defend yourself. Even the most peaceful king and lord, overlord will do it, have to do it. And then the neighbor gets afraid because they see that you get weapons, they get weapons, and so comes an arms race, and so comes war almost automatically. The motto is, if you want peace, prepare for war. This is the motto of the past 10,000 years, and nobody could escape it. And it leads almost automatically to war, even though it is designed to avoid it, but it leads to war. So it's a dilemma. Therefore, it's called dilemma. Okay. So if we now think, how can we overcome this dilemma? Can we? So this is my life's work, because if you want to overcome it, you have to build one global in-group where there is no out-group that can attack from outside.
I see.
That's the only way.
No borders.
No, yeah, borders. You might need certain borders, but not like today. You know, you might want to, like in Norway, as an example, keeps a border to keep dogs out who might bring rabies. I think they have to go in quarantine or so. So there is a border. A certain border is there. Or you, if you think of the Amazon, where I'm coming from now, you have uncontacted tribes. You want to make a border around them so that they remain uncontacted. So what kind of border do we need? You know, not the borders of now, but some kind of borders. But the at the core, if we really want to overcome this security dilemma, we need to build a global, you know, we need to manifest the fact that we as Homo sapiens are one species, one family on one tiny planet, and we have to be one in-group without out-groups, without enemies. We have to eliminate the notion of enemies. We can have bad neighbors and good neighbors, that's possible, but the notion of enemies and war, we can, you know, if we want to have peace on this planet, real peace with dignity, not just oppression, peace through oppression, then we need to be one global family. And how do we become one global family? By coming together. And this is what I do. I'm a global nurturer of a global family.
You mentioned the idea of peace with dignity. And of course, we're also interested in the relationship with money and the trade and the way those phenomena impact our global relationships. How would you describe your relationship between dignity and peace, and also dignity and money?
Right. Of course, if we look at North Korea, we would say this is not peace, even though the leader of North Korea will say this is very peaceful here. And we can say there is perhaps some kind of stability and order. Surely. So stability and order is not necessarily peace. It's called, can be called cultural violence. You know, Johan Galtung would call it structural violence. And so, of course, dignified peace is a peace that is manifested through dialogue between people who respect each other as equals in dignity. That is the peace I work for, and that I think we all here work for. So, and money is a huge topic there, because at the moment I think the way money is defined and disseminated and produced and created is making this aim, this ambition, this vision impossible.
Evelyn, we've heard you actually live your life without money. Could you explain a little bit why you do that and how it relates to your work on dignity? Why go that far?
Right. Not completely. Of course, one cannot be 100%, but as much as possible, I live without money. Two days ago, I have a good friend who is a Wall Street Wall Street boy, and he looks at money always. So we went to the Rubin Museum, and we admired everything, and I also was very struck by a very good idea, the sleeping overnight in front of a piece of art. And this is an offer the Rubin Museum gives to people. I think it's a wonderful idea. And so then I went out, and he said, look, yeah, this is an amazing sales pitch, because imagine there's a family, and then they give it as a birthday present to their kid to sleep under a dinosaur. The kid will never forget it. He will be a lifelong subscriber to the Rubin Museum, and it will be it's a multi-generational sales pitch. Okay, here we have a wonderful idea, and the fact, and I went in, when he said that, I went back, and And he said, I'm sure the woman didn't say. She said, oh, I don't know how much it costs. And he said, I'm sure she knows because it must be very expensive. And so I went back and I asked how much. And they didn't want to say it. $112 for sleeping at night in front of a piece of art. Okay, so I came out and he said, you see, very expensive. So this is a sales pitch. So, you know, and you go around in the world, wherever you go, and even the nicest idea, you know, when you look behind it, it's just a cover for money. And so this man, my dear friend, he is basically thoroughly a cynic. The whole world is cynical because everything is a cover for money. And even the nicest ideas loses its integrity. There is no integrity. So the whole world has lost its integrity.
I see. Yes.
So this is just 2 days ago. Therefore, I explain it in that way. But there are, of course, many, many, many other ways to explain it. But integrity, we have we started our dignity work in 2001, 2003. And in the beginning, Linda and I, we do it together. Linda is the other person I know who has written her doctorate on humiliation like me. So we are, until now, I think the only two people in the world who have written a doctorate on the topic of humiliation and dignity as a violation of dignity. And so Linda and I, we were always approached and people told us, look, you know, we understand you don't want to take money from Coca-Cola or from arms product, you know, companies or... But look here, you know, we give you some money so you can hire some students to do your, you know, I have about 2,000 important emails waiting at any time, you know, a huge overload of work. I should never sleep and Linda should never sleep. So people said, look here, you have money, hire some students, you know, and we tried in 2003, 2005 or so. And it's a disaster. It doesn't work because you cannot... do, you know, project dignity if you do it for money.
Why is that?
You must.
I mean, some people say working for money gives you dignity.
Yeah, that is the American turn on the notion of dignity. I'm just about to finish a book on dignity and humiliation, and there I went through all the definition of dignity. And one, you know, one approach to dignity is here in the States that dignity basically is a useless concept and that autonomy would be much better. And that as you said, that it's perhaps dignity, you get dignity through getting money. And so one example is perhaps the bubble that burst the... When the mortgage bubble, it started with this idea, you know, that people who have a home, a house, who can afford also to pay a loan are dignified through that. So the banks were encouraged to give loans to people so that they could be dignified. Then the banks packaged these loans in ways that were irresponsible, and the result was that everybody, or many, many people, lost their homes. And they lost their dignity, and they lost something that they might have had before, namely a dignity without a home. They suddenly had learned to equate dignity with a home and the ability to be able to pay back a loan, and suddenly... everything is destroyed. So they were worse off than before. And I see that all over the world with microfinancing. There is this notion at the bottom, we give you some money and you are dignified, you can do something and you're dignified through your ability to pay back. And the poor people we know now are a good source because they repay quite well if they can. But just lately, there was somebody who wanted to come, a microfinancier, who wanted to come to our conference in Egypt. And he had come to our conference in Rwanda. And there we were surrounded by people who had lost everything because they could not pay back. And the project that they had started with that loan was not feasible, and so then they could not pay back, and they were worse off than before. And this man wanted to come to our conference in Egypt, and I said, you know, you can come, but be prepared that I will have to humiliate you by saying that I think that inviting people by loans into, especially also into producing stuff, more stuff, this planet cannot carry that we produce more stuff. Mm. It cannot carry that. So to invite people into producing more stuff and call that dignifying is the wrong way. And then this, the problem with the money, you know, on top of that.
For me, you really walk your talk in your personal life. So there's like words and the right energy. It's, for me, this is truth. So you do walk your talk. You bring out what you believe in into this world, as you just described, but you also live accordingly. So can you describe us a little bit, how do you manage a life, your personal life, without money?
As I said, it's not completely without money, but as much as possible. I live far below the poverty line. And the little money, like I need money for an airplane ticket. I cannot hitchhike there, you know. So like we will have our workshop now with 60 to 70 people, and they collect the money for my ticket, for example. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that money is there, but not, you know, I would not, I am not somebody who wants to sell something. I don't want to sell my body. I don't want to sell a product. I don't want to sell my services. I'm not on sale. I'm not payable. I don't want to be paid. So I'm not a commodity. I'm a human being. I don't want to have things. I want to be. It's the Erich Fromm. It's an old book, Erich Fromm, having or being, or to have or to be. So I want to be, I don't want to have, and I don't want to exchange. It is, I think we talked about this Alan Page Fiskus, research anthropologist, who found out that basically there are four, perhaps five, but four basic ways of collaborating in a society, and the most comprehensive is what a good family does. I give, and this is what I do, I give what I have, I give, and I never think of having to have something back. I never calculate. I never say,
I never measure it.
And I have no calculator in my head.
Let's come back to this definition. So, the family.
Yeah, the family is the most comprehensive. Mathematics, if a mathematician is listening, this is the most comprehensive, is the nominal scala of measurement. Mm-hmm. And then comes authority ranking, which is could be the good teacher, the good parent, or it could be the bad dictator. And then you have equality matching, which means I take care of your cat if you water my plants. There you start to calculate, you know, to measure. And then you have a market pricing, where you have a ratio. So it's the nominal, ordinal, interval, ratio scale in mathematics. And so the market pricing is the most reductionist, and communal sharing the most comprehensive. And at the moment, we live in a world where the most reductionist way of approaching collaboration is given priority in our society, which if we really manifest it 100%, we sell our soul, we sell our grandmother, we have to sell everything and to buy everything. Mm. And we have to basically no relationships that are like in a family anymore. We should define that out. And this is what is happening. It's defined out more and more. So from my point of view, this is the wrong priority. We have to switch it again and to go and to see how far can I go in manifesting what a family does. So I go around in the world and I explain that. And for example, let us say, and I have some pictures here with me, I will show you later. for example, India. We had our conference in 2017 in India, and we always wait for our network members to say, we want your conference here. So somebody 2 years before had said that, okay, I think this university there where my brother-in-law or so is working, they should have your conference. And he contacted them and they said, yes, we want your conference. So 2 years of working. So I write an email to this this university, and I get a response, and they expect me to come some days before the conference and live in a hotel and then go again. And then I write to them, this is not how I live. Please, I need to find, I will stay much longer, minimum 2 months, and you need to find a family for me where I can be part. I want to, you know, come to India and to your Madhya Pradesh, and I want, after 2 months, I want to feel as if I'm born there. And I want to be the little sister in a family, you know, because I haven't been in India much at all. So I don't know. I need to be somewhere. You have to find that. They are, of course, shocked, and they think it must be crazy. They don't believe it, sometimes not until the last moment. So I say I have no plan B. I don't have any booking in any hotel. You know, and then they, you know, this happens again and again and again.
That
in many places, and then I arrive at the airport, and often then I learn later what they have gone through before. You know. So then I arrive. Okay, and the man who from the university who picks me up, he brings me to a place, and I always need about a week to recover from a flight, and I'm not made for flying. You know, I suffer from the air in the plane. So 1 week. So after I recovered, the wonderful lady where I was staying, she brought me to the university. I met all the faculty members. I brought my gifts. You know, I have the picture of my gifts, big, big table with gifts. They explained them the circle of love gifts, and they are very astonished. They expected a Western lady with high-heeled shoes who would teach them how to do business, how to make money, how to forget their Indian traditions. And they were so, so surprised. And then, you know, came the principal of this place, and he said, Evelyn, you know, he was very astonished, and he invited me to lunch. And then after lunch, he said, Evelyn, pack your things. You are part of our family. He packed me into his car and brought me to the house where he and his wife and his mother were living in the midst of an extended family. And I became part of that family. And I'm the sister. His sister and or his wife's sister, and I normally don't take clothes of my own clothes, only minimum, and I count on wearing the clothes of the people where I stay. So Amita, her name is Amita. She was ironing every morning her one piece of clothes from her very colorful, wonderful Indian, and each day I was another Indian lady. And Rajesh, her husband, was my brother. He made the food. He helped Amita to write novels, so he was the one to making food. And I was told everything because I don't know. And I learned and learned and learned and learned. And it was absolutely a stunning, a wonderful experience for me and for them. They said, okay, we have never, they can't say their lives is now kind of separated. They say, oh, there is a life before Evelyn and after Evelyn. And yeah, because they were the only ones, and I think we had such a deep understanding, and they were somehow so much on this, my way of thinking, that it is very difficult for them to talk to other people in their neighborhood and their family. So we had an understanding, a depth of understanding that was so wonderful that it had, it was an amazing gift for all of us.
It reminds me of that movie, American movie, where the star says, I think it might be Grace Kelly, I always rely on the kindness of strangers. But in that movie, it's a joke, not the reality that it is for you.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of connection without zero money exchanged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this gives it integrity and credibility only because I can prove that I don't have a big mansion somewhere, that I don't have a Ferrari, that I don't collect money to have a second Ferrari or Porsche. You know, only that, through that, the fact that I really show that the way I live gives this work credibility and integrity. Only that. Mm-hmm. So if I were employed somewhere, I would immediately lose the globality of this life. I would be associated with the locality, like if I were employed at a university somewhere, I would be associated with the national interest of that country. Or if I were employed or would take the money of Ford Foundation or some kind of foundation, I would immediately lose all my integrity.
This is a beautiful story. And I think one point we can address here that we didn't actually cover in our interview with Evelyn is the question of exploitation and the difference between getting very intentional, building community intentionally and building family that Evelyn does. I mean, someone might just think she's taking advantage of their hospitality.
Mm-hmm. Evelyn herself is aware of this pitfall, and she shared with us that she does everything in her power to avoid exploiting people in the places she visits, whether that means offering her services as a medical doctor or psychologist or bringing other kinds of gifts for her hosts. She's very clear that living without money should not exploit people, and she makes the point that love cannot be bought.
Certainly not. I mean, if we think about this in terms of Alan Fiske's model that she just presented to us, the four levels of sharing, communal sharing, authority ranking, equality matching, and market pricing, she's actually taking an interaction that would normally be a market pricing interaction, in other words, paying for a hotel room for a few nights, and transforming that into a communal relationship where she's entering a family, for example, in India, where what's theirs is hers and what's hers is theirs.
Evelyn's commitment to her own lifestyle is absolutely remarkable, and mm-hmm. I've never seen anyone with that much integrity. We wanted to know if she saw everyone living their lives this way.
Evelyn, why? You know, it really is hard for me to imagine anyway living this life, you know, with children or even with a pet. I can't imagine. And you have managed to do it. Would you want everyone to live this life? Is that what your goal is?
No. We have thought a lot about how to dignify conferences, and we found this open space technology to be very good, and I live according to that. Open space technology was invented many years ago when people detected that academic conferences are terribly boring and the only thing that is interesting is the coffee break. And so the decision was, okay, then we make the whole conference as a coffee break. And what is the characteristic of a coffee break? And if you think through it, then you can develop a format. And this is what we build on that, and we call it Dignity Dialogue format of our conferences. And in this format, the people who are there on the first day, we never pay anybody to come. So we are sometimes surprised who is there. Okay, we know we send out invitations, so we know more or less who is there. So the people who are there on the first day, they are the right people who are there, like in a coffee break. And then we ask them who would like to lead a dignilogue, a dialogue. Those who want to lead one, they give, you know, write the topic on a piece of paper, and then the others write their names if they are interested in their topic. And then we make on the first day the program for the next days together. And the one who leads Dignilogue, he has to stay. And then there is some other role there. It's the bee, the bumblebee. The bumblebee is the person who goes from group to group, if they are parallel groups, and pollinates them. So this is my role. And I need the flowers. A bee needs the flowers who are, who stay where they are. So both is needed. I couldn't be at home in the home of Amita and Rajesh if they had no home. So, I am the bee. So this is my role. I'm like global nurturer of this garden, you could say. I'm the bee who nurtures and pollinates this garden, but the flowers need to stay.
And you encourage the flowers
and
to stay.
And I encourage the flowers to stay. Like, as I said, I'm coming from the Amazon now, and there I encourage the people to stay. Because the people who know how to live sustainably in this complex system of the rainforest, they need to stay. Like on uncontacted tribes, we don't want to leave. Of course, we don't want to incarcerate them there and say you can't leave. That's, of course, a discussion in itself, because many of these indigenous peoples, they don't want to stay. And we idealize them if we say they must stay, and we force them to make a museum out of their lives. Okay, this is too far, but still, you know, I met people who were told by the big corporations, look, you are fishermen here at this river, and this river we will destroy, we will poison, you know, you will have to leave because we need it, and you are staying in the way of progress. And they believed it. And I said, look, you know, you are the progress. You know how to live sustainably here. You are the progress. The world should come to you and learn from you.
I think we also had a question for you about if you've had any serious challenge living like this. Like, have you been vilified in any way or sabotaged, or, you know, have you experienced, what is the biggest challenge that you've experienced?
At the moment, I'm looking for a partner, and my friends have subscribed me on all these dating platforms. And I'm very reluctant to log in because I get insulted.
Wow.
Yes.
Insulted.
Yes. Insulted because you don't live...
No, yes. I have to present myself as the person with that integrity, that I'm not a private person. I will not go and play golf. I have a mission, and I have to say that, you know, mm-hmm. and to, so that also if network members of our network suddenly fall and see my profile, could be, you know, that they know that I'm the same person. I'm not a different person there. You know, I'm always the same person. I'm a public and private person. It's the same. So, so then I get insulted, you know, like, you know, crazy people are everywhere or whatever, you know. So I'm very reluctant on, yes.
Well, your friends have to tell you when a good one comes along.
Yes.
What comes up for me, Evelyn, in your work, there's a lot of healing. There's a lot of healing for the earth in there. Yeah, as you say, you have the bumblebee going from flower to flower.
Mm-hmm.
And the money level has a lot to do with that healing for the earth. And I think you explained it before, right? But what is the advice for people who want to live like this, or want to heal, or want to participate in that kind of healing? What kind of advice could you give?
I think the most important thing is, if we think about money, is to be informed how money, what money is. It's a fiat currency. It is made of debt. You know, the mechanisms of how money is made, and whether really private banks are the right ones to make currencies and. So to get informed about money, I think that is extremely important. Like I just saw this interview with and Trevor Noah with Greta Thunberg on, and she said, she was asked the same question, you know, what do you advise people? And she said, get informed. And I think that is the good mm-hmm. advice, get informed. And of course, we don't, when we buy a refrigerator or a TV, it's not necessarily that we need to understand everything, how that works. But money, everybody should learn what it is and how it works and how it should work. And the same with climate. People should get informed. This is where everybody needs to get more informed.
And they're so related, money and climate.
Exactly.
And peace.
Yes, exactly. So therefore, I think these are the areas where people need to get much more informed. You don't need to get informed about who has been winning the last soccer game or whatever, you know, I don't want to somehow deride people who like soccer, but somehow the priorities must be right.
I just wanted to offer you a chance to share any last pieces of wisdom you'd like to share or something you want to get onto the air or
no,
share with your friends.
What I would like to say is that I profoundly appreciate your initiative to interview people and to, I think this is the nurturing work that needs to be done on this planet, and you do it. And and you are not, you know, the way you ask me now was very open and very unafraid. And that I appreciate profoundly, because I meet, I'm saddened by the fact that my way of living that is supposed to be inspiring is often provocative, too much. And I'm saddened by that fact. And I'm always happy when I meet people who are open and curious and not frightened. And I'm profoundly appreciative of you, you know, inviting
me. Thank you for the flowers, Evelyn. and we can also, of course, include a link on the show notes, how to get in contact with you. Mm-hmm. And if you want to have more open people to maybe contact you mm-hmm. or become part of your network
right.
or your conferences, mm-hmm. wherever they are, mm-hmm. that we are happily doing that.
Wonderful.
Yes, thank you so much.
I have to thank you really deeply.
It was such an honor and joy to speak with Evelyn, and we hope you all got as much from this conversation here as we did.
Mm-hmm. And if you're interested in learning more about Evelyn's work, check out her book, A Dignity Economy, which we'll link at the bottom of our show notes.
And in honor of Evelyn, all of you listening out there are part of our Pot of Gold global family now, so feel free to reach out and share your thoughts with us about this episode.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore.
Thanks for listening.